Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Friday the 13th of November, 2015. The Supreme Court will review an important abortion case.
Having my baby.
Well, it's the law in many states now.
What a lovely way of saying how much you love me. Having my baby.
Now, these new state laws, pushed by the pro-birth religious right wing in this country, do not actually compel a woman to carry a baby to term. They just prevent the alternative, which, of course, is a protected right, as enumerated by the Supreme Court in Roe v. Wade, that a woman may choose to terminate a pregnancy. But the forces of repression have organized in a very clever and orchestrated way with deceptive, pretextual legislation. And these are the laws that say, oh, yeah, you can run an abortion clinic, but they make so many restrictions that it's impossible to actually do so. And in Texas, which once had 40 abortion clinics scattered around that sprawling state, there are now only 10, and their existence is threatened by a recent law. So the Supreme Court, I'm glad to hear, has agreed to hear this, but I cannot predict the outcome. Because we have 5 Catholics on the court, and Justice Kennedy is the presumed swing vote, but we don't have a test of the 2 Obama appointees. And we really don't know how those 2 women will vote on these matters. And so there could be a rollback. The Texas law could be accepted. It could be partly modified. Or this could lead to a wholesale upending of Roe v. Wade. We really don't know how the court will see this case. But if it accepts precedence, and think back to these bizarre confirmation hearings of Supreme Court candidates, like Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito. And you remember the phrase stare decisis? Do you remember the late Senator Arlen Specter from Pennsylvania, a Republican who switched parties in a desperate effort to hold on to his seat, but it failed? Arlen Specter quizzed, I think it was Alito, about precedents, court precedents decided by the Supreme Court. Would he be deferential to those precedents? Would he honor what Specter called super precedents and super duper precedents? You remember that? I sure do. Well, the precedent in this case is 1992 decision by the Supreme Court in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which said that states may not place undue burdens on the constitutional right to abortion before viability of a fetus. The court said undue burdens included unnecessary health regulations that have the purpose or effect of presenting a substantial obstacle to a woman seeking an abortion. Well, that's exactly what these right-wing nuts have done in state after state across the country. And as I'll mention later in this podcast, this problem is exaggerated by the huge swing toward Republican control of state legislatures and governorships since Obama became president. So we know, for example, that it is an unnecessary health regulation when states demand that a clinic and its doctor have visiting privileges or access privileges at a nearby hospital. Abortion is one of the safest procedures that occurs outside of hospital surgery rooms. And if the court is honest about that, and if it honors its own precedent, well, it must reject the Texas law and its clones that have taken effect all across the country. The other issue is whether the distance that a woman has to travel to an abortion clinic poses an undue burden. In Mississippi, they're trying to shut down the only remaining clinic there, saying, well, you know, it's not so far to go to Georgia or Florida or somewhere else that offers abortion services, but we don't want it here in Mississippi. Well, I consider that to be an undue burden. But will the current members of the Supreme Court? We'll find out at the end of June in 2016. This will be one of the last decisions that the court will release at the end of its term. And I want to credit the Guardian newspaper, which often provides better coverage of American domestic issues than our own corporate media here. But in an article published on Thursday, they note that state bans on abortion access are growing all across the country. And Pennsylvania is one state where now women seeking an abortion are required to get a pamphlet and read it 24 hours before their appointment. And it is a document that is attempting to change their minds, often with misleading information. And this occurs in the Cherry Hill Women's Center. That's where the article is focused. And that's Cherry Hill, just across the border from Pennsylvania in New Jersey. And there is no waiting period. There is no requirement to read those documents. And there are other much more favorable regulations that cause women to leave Pennsylvania and go to New Jersey to get an abortion. And this, again, requires crossing state lines, and sometimes that's only 20 miles, but sometimes it's hundreds of miles. And what is the standard of an undue burden on a woman's access? In Maryland and Minnesota, the operator, and this is not Planned Parenthood, it's a group called Whole Woman's Health that operates abortion clinics. And they've lost hundreds of thousands of dollars performing abortions for poor women on Medicaid because the states reimburse abortion providers, but the cost to perform the abortion is much higher. And so this is just another way that access is limited as the operators are squeezed financially. And so this is a virus that is spreading across the country. And with the orchestrated attack on Planned Parenthood, which only provides about a third of the abortions nationwide, this is a very serious problem. And I often feel that I am the only voice raising these issues and demanding that progressives, people on the political left, fight back. Far too many people I find to be passive in the face of all this. Interesting turnabout in the state of Utah, where a judge reversed a decision he had announced just yesterday. And at least temporarily, he is changing his court order that a foster child be taken away from a lesbian couple because of their sexual orientation. Juvenile Court Judge Scott Johansson had issued an order saying that the child, a 9-month-old girl, should be removed from the couple's home by the end of the day and by the end of next Tuesday and placed with a heterosexual couple. Now, Utah is one of those states that has been resisting the Supreme Court's decision on marriage equality, and this is an issue that flows right from that. If same-sex couples are recognized by the Supreme Court, then their right to adoption has to be recognized as well. And Judge Johansson is having a little trouble processing all that. He had put one line into the ruling that was eliminated from the turnabout ruling, where he said it's not in the best interest of children to be raised by same-sex couples. Now, there's no citation of any scientific study or social experts who were quoted. That appears to be the judge's personal opinion. And then he modified the line to read, the court cited a concern that research has shown that children are more emotionally and mentally stable when raised by a mother and father in the same home. Well, yeah, that'd be nice, Judge Johansson, but right there in juvenile court, you see the product of divorce on a daily basis. And so this idea that heterosexual couples are held to a lower standard than same-sex couples is blatantly discriminatory. So the couple in question here, Rebecca Pierce and April Hoagland, get to keep this foster child whose mother has abandoned it and whose father is in prison. And they share two biological children, of one of the couple there. Her name is Pierce. So it's not like, you know, they are people who have no experience in raising kids. And to me, any couple of any description who wants to commit to taking a foster child and raising it, I think should be applauded and supported, not subject to bullshit morality lectures from a juvenile court judge. Well, is Donald Trump unraveling? That's the question that's circulating today, because in Iowa last night, he went off on a lengthy rant. And I haven't seen the videos yet. I've just been reading print accounts. But he went after Ben Carson, the African-American child neurosurgeon who has surprised everyone by matching or in some cases beating Donald Trump in the polls. Now, you may know that in one of his books, Ben Carson revealed what he described as his own pathological temper as a child and a teenager. And he claims that he tried to stab a guy. Nobody can really confirm that story. And so Trump referred to the admission of Ben Carson that he had a pathological temper. And then he took it to the next level. He said, "How stupid are the people of Iowa? How stupid are the people of the country to believe this crap?" And then he went on to parse the word pathological and compare it to a child molester. And without citing any evidence or science, Trump just offered the kind of, you know, conventional wisdom. He said, you know, that's a big problem because you don't cure that. That's like, you know, I could say they say you don't cure, as an example, a child molester. You don't cure these people. You don't cure the child molester. Well, he's on very shifty ground here. And in some cases, people consider this clever. He didn't actually say that Ben Carson was a child molester or acts like one. He just said that his personal problem, which he has confessed to, is similar to that of a child molester because you can't cure it. Well, I don't think Trump is qualified to make these kinds of judgments. And, you know, I share the concerns and the doubts that many people have about the credibility of Ben Carson. But in this ham-handed attempt, the man with the out-of-control ego, Herr Trump, may have wounded himself, maybe fatally. Because Carson, in many respects, is such a different kind of candidate. And he gets protection from evangelicals, from racist Republicans who hate Barack Obama because he's black, but embrace Ben Carson because he's a black capitalist right-winger. And attacking Carson is a very dangerous adventure on Trump's part. And in full New York mode, he kept telling the crowd, "Give me a break. Give me a break." And even went to the extent of acting out the scene of Carson trying to stab his friend, inviting somebody up to the stage to, you know, go through the motions of stabbing Trump in the belt. And the final quote here from Trump is, "And the people of Iowa believe him. Give me a break. Give me a break. Doesn't happen that way. Don't be fools." I mean, that's the other thing, is insulting voters is always a risky proposition for candidates who are busy pandering to those same voters. And here's a blog post from the Daily News Bin. You can look it up if you want, dailynewsbin.com. And I don't know the credibility of this source, so I'll share it with this information with you on that basis. The unnamed author here writes, "Ben Carson has yet another problem in the honesty department. After a week in which many of his claims made in his books about his personal life have been exposed as phony, The issue's compounded by the fact that long sections of one of the books have been copied and pasted from other people's work. Now, this was the problem Joe Biden ran into, and it wasn't a book. He borrowed a British politician's lines in a speech. And that plagiarism attack or issue plagued Joe Biden right up to his decision not to run for president next year. So according to this writer, Carson's 2012 book, America the Beautiful, contains instances of plagiarism from at least three different sources. So we'll see if that surfaces as an issue. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins podcast. And I've just noted that Agnes Mulhaizen has taken out a second annual subscription. Agnes lives in the UK. I sent her her bonus book gift the other day, and she responded. So, Agnes, thank you very much for your generosity and your additional generosity. It's really touching. And I also want to acknowledge that I finally got possession of a package that was sent by Del Leonard. Del is a longtime listener to the Peter B. Collins Show back when I was on AM radio, and he stayed with us as we moved to podcasting. He has been my vice president for marketing in New England for years, and he's a really solid guy. And Dell sent me a priority mail package via the U.S. Post that got lost at the Mill Valley Post Office for a couple of weeks. But it has been found, and I picked it up yesterday, and it included his check for a renewal of his annual subscription, along with several books and some DVDs for me to consume and to use as fodder for future programs. So, Dell, Agnes, I salute you both today, and I'm very grateful. I'd like to ask others to join in. It's your turn. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click that menu button in the upper right corner. That takes you to a pull-down menu, and you choose Become a Subscriber. And there you get to choose $5, $10, $20 a month, the $50 annual subscription. We've got the new app for iPads and iPhones, and more people are picking that up every month. You can find it in the Apple App Store. And I got word this week that our podcasts are now being beamed through a system that is set up for Android phone users. And I've got to investigate to confirm that it's there, and I'll do that and then pass the information along to you in the next few days. Yesterday was a bloody day in Beirut, Lebanon. It's expected that the bombs that were detonated were borne by two suicide bombers who went into a southern Beirut neighborhood to blow up Shiites and members of Hezbollah. And the Islamic State has already taken responsibility for the attack, which, again, widens this conflict. And there are other flashpoints in the ongoing war in Syria and Iraq. Yesterday at Mount Sinjar in the northwest corner of Iraq, Kurdish forces, guided by American advisors and buoyed by American airstrikes, cut off a supply route to Daesh forces, about 7,000 of them, who are hunkered down in the town of Sinjar. They've been there for a couple of years since they kicked out the Yazidi population and took over this vantage point. So that's a claim of some success by U.S.-backed forces. You note there's no mention of Iraqi fighters, only Kurdish fighters, along with U.S. support. Also, the Pentagon and the British government are claiming that we have almost certainly killed the guy known as Jihadi John, a British citizen named Mohammed Emwazi, who came to notoriety because he was the English-speaking guy who was, all covered up, disguised, and he hosted the propaganda videos where hostages were beheaded. So he has been a target of the U.S. and Britain since the British exposed his identity earlier this year. And he is the person believed to be responsible for the beheading of the American journalist James Foley and another one named Stephen Sotloff. And I want to credit Foley's family, because in an era where there are so many bloodthirsty people who welcome barbarism, whether it's conducted by the Islamic State or in retaliation for their own barbaric actions. Foley's parents, John and Diane, said they were not comforted by the news of the attack. If only so much effort had been given to rescuing Jim and the other hostages who were subsequently murdered by the Islamic State, they might be alive today. The U.S. has conducted more than 8,000 airstrikes in the last 14 months against the Islamic State, with very little noticeable impact. And now, I don't know what the timing of this is, but the U.S., apparently infuriated by the $40 million a month that Daesh has been able to generate from sales of oil from fields it controls in Syria and Iraq, we have stepped up bombing on oil facilities and oil fields in Syria. This started on October 21st when B-1 bombers and other Allied warplanes hit 26 targets in the Omar oil field, one of the two largest production sites in all of Syria. And this revamped plan for attacking oil-related sites comes after weeks of intense study of 8 major fields to determine how to inflict more financial pain on the Islamic State. Now, John Kerry is going to hold another one of those confabs in Vienna. I love Vienna. I'd be happy to go there and spend the weekend, but not to meet with John Kerry and the representatives of countries who are trying to hammer out some sort of understanding to stop the conflict in Syria. Only the government of Syria and the various rebel groups are not participating. And the U.S. continues to hold to the fantasy that it can negotiate Bashar al-Assad's resignation or removal from office in Damascus. And so I don't know what Kerry thinks he's going to achieve by, on the one hand, cheering on the war against the Islamic State, on the other hand, saying that Assad must step down, that the rebels will never accept any kind of a transition where he stays in power. And we have absolutely no leverage over any of these people. It's ridiculous. The International Criminal Court has increased its review of alleged crimes committed by British military personnel in Iraq. And you might be scratching your head saying, what? Well, there are cases, reported deaths of more than 250 individuals, and widespread reports of abuse and mistreatment of hundreds more. Now, the International Criminal Court did do an investigation that ended in 2006, but then they reopened it in 2014, looking into a litany of abuses allegedly perpetrated by British forces after the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. The violations include burning, electrocution, mock executions, threats to detainees' families, sexual assault, forced exposure to pornography, and the alleged killing of at least 8 Iraqis while in the custody of U.K. forces. Now there's a new ICC report which included reference to 259 unlawful killings of civilians, 47 of whom were Iraqis who reportedly died in UK custody. Now, the reason you don't hear that the United States is a co-defendant of Britain in the International Criminal Court proceedings is that we don't recognize the ICC. We've never signed that treaty, and so we pretend that we are still the good guys in the white hats and above the rule of law as it is upheld by others. The refugee flow into Europe is becoming overwhelming. Sweden has reluctantly announced that it is tightening its borders and limiting the number of Middle Eastern refugees who can come into the country from now on. It had been a pretty much open-door policy. They never expected this many people to enter that open door. But it's creating a real problem, and the European Union is meeting in Malta for a couple of days. And one of the deals is they've offered Turkey about $3.2 billion to support refugee camps and other measures to keep the refugees from leaving Turkey and Greece and emigrating toward Europe. And, well, let me read the next story, and then we'll tie them together here. The headline is, Greece disrupted by general strike over amnesty. Hundreds of thousands of Greeks walked off their jobs Thursday to protest austerity economics. And my point here is that if the European Union has found an extra $3 billion, why don't they give some of that money to Greece? After all, it was the Europeans and their banks who have driven the austerity program and denied relief to Greece. Greece has been heavily impacted by the refugee crisis. Lesbos is the island that is easiest for people to cross from Turkey into Greek territory on. I don't get it. I really don't. Was it a mistake or an intentional revelation to rattle the West? On a Russian TV channel the other day, a secret nuclear weapon delivery system was exposed as the camera focused on a document that was being displayed at a meeting of military officials. This secret nuclear weapons delivery system is a drone submarine that could attack coastlines, and it could create serious problems, quote, defeat important economic objects of an enemy in coastal zones, bringing guaranteed and unacceptable losses on the country's territory by forming a wide area of radioactive contamination incompatible with conducting military, economic, or any other activities for a very long period of time. Well, it sounds to me like this is a weapon system that is on the drawing boards, and that this was a calculated effort to show the United States and others who are challenging Russia that we should be afraid, very, very afraid. I mentioned earlier in the discussion about abortion rights that since Barack Obama became president, the Democratic Party has lost badly in elections for the state legislatures and governorships across the country. So as of January, with the Republican victory in Kentucky, the GOP will occupy 32 of the nation's governorships. That's up from 10 from 2009. And the Democrats in the state legislatures are showing their worst levels of representation in 115 years. 816 Democratic lawmakers have lost their jobs since Obama became president. Now, it's not all his fault, right? He runs the federal government and, you know, the national political party is nominally under his control. But the Democrats have not been competitive. And when they started losing in 2010, just as the redistricting cycle prompted by the 2010 census kicked in, we saw that gerrymandering was made possible by these all-red state legislatures with governors. And the abortion rights rollback has flowed from that. The attacks on Planned Parenthood have flowed from that. So the Democratic Party has led itself into a corner of irrelevance. And it's going to take a lot to regain. And in my view, the party has damaged its brand even more badly in the last few years by all the compromises that have been imposed by Obama on domestic spying, on war powers, and on many other issues that show the Democratic leadership out of touch with rank-and-file members and progressives who choose not to be members of the Democratic Party. People like me. Here in California, you may know that we have the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals sit in San Francisco. That circuit court, that Court of Appeals, has a reputation as being uber-liberal. But George W. Bush put people like the torture memo writer Jay Bybee on the Ninth Circuit. And yesterday, the formerly liberal Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled unanimously in overturning a lower court ruling that had declared our death penalty here unconstitutional because of excessive delays. Now, it is an unusual argument. I'll grant that. And the court acknowledged that. Justice Susan Graber, writing for the unanimous court, said many agree that California's capital punishment system is dysfunctional and that the delay between sentencing and execution is extraordinary. But the purpose of federal habeas corpus is to ensure that state convictions comply with the federal law in existence at the time the conviction became final, and not to provide a mechanism for the continuing reexamination of final judgments based upon later emerging legal doctrine. So it was nice try, not here, and while it certainly will be appealed, the U.S. Supreme Court showed its hand earlier this year by saying, we don't care how you put these people to death. We don't care if the drug cocktail causes them to convulse on the table for 45 minutes. Just kill them. And don't bother to tell us how, and don't bring us any more of these cases. And finally today, I don't know how many of you who have visited San Francisco know who Carol Dodo was. Our red light district, or at least one of them, it's called North Beach. It's at the intersection of Columbus and Broadway. The City Lights bookstore is an icon on one of those corners. And opposite City Lights is the Condor. And the Condor was a strip club. It's now just a bar. They don't have topless women there. But going back to the 1960s, Carol Dodo became one of the best-known topless dancers in the country, if not the world. And her large breasts were depicted in a neon sign outside the Condor for years, even after she had stopped stripping. And she went on to sell erotic toys and oils and lingerie and things like that. Always a colorful character here in San Francisco. And her legend was enhanced by the way she performed at the Condor Club. The music would play, and she would descend from the ceiling, standing on top of a white baby grand piano. And that's where she would bump and grind and remove her top. Many drinks were sold. Many patrons have memories. And I have to say, I never darkened the doors of the Condor. Well, maybe I was in there once for a drink, but I never saw any bare boobs, including Carol Dodo's. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. You're free to share this podcast with absolutely everyone, so please get started. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.